Okay, today I'm in Warwickshire with Cornelius Lysett. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
Nice to see you. Nice to see you.
Now, for a generation of racing fans, you were the voice of the sport with the BBC. And that came to a fairly abrupt end in April 2020. Was it a shock to you?
Well, it was a yes and no. As with all these things, every time you go for renewal talks, you think, gosh, will things continue? But you always think you're actually just trying to make yourself sort of keep your feet on the ground so that when everything continues as per normal, you feel better about it. So I went to them. I had dinner with some friends the night before. And I said to them, I've just got a bad feeling about tomorrow. And they said, oh, don't be stupid, don't be silly. And I was right to have a bad feeling. And that they were decent enough to give me 7 months' notice. So it was not, it was just before the Arc de Triomphe, actually. And nothing better that if you've had a bit of bad news than to get to Paris for a weekend to cheer yourself up. So, you know, there are all sorts of problems, one of which was money. Clearly, the BBC, like all organisations, is trying to save money where it can. And the other difficulty for horse racing, for racing as a whole, has, however important those within the bubble, see Enable, see Champions Day, see Cheltenham, see these big events all the way through the year, racing status in the world is not what it used to be. And quite when that changed and why that changed, I don't think anyone exactly knows, but the fact is, once upon a time, if you were a captain of industry or a senior politician or whatever, having a horse, having a racehorse to race in your colours was sort of a thing that you did. And so lots of movers and shakers were involved in racing. That was to the benefit of racing. And in 2020, or the first part of the 21st century, that's not so much the case. So racing status has taken a hit, I took the hit. That was part of the reason. It's not the sole reason, but it was certainly part of the reason that I ended up taking a hit as well.
Okay, we'll explore a bit about the reasoning behind the decline of racing in the eyes of the main media a bit later on. You talk about the movers and shakers. Now, when I research my interviewees, it's very rare that I can go back in their ancestry to the 16th century, which I did with you via one of the peerage websites.
Gracious.
Is that something you've been interested in? You've got a fascinating family history.
Well, I know that I've always fancied Who Do You Think You Are on television. I always think that the licence fee, people moan about £145, which is probably quite a lot of money to lots of people. But I always think Who Do You Think You Are is a series where people look back at their family histories, which is worth the £145 in one go. But are you about to come up with some shocking revelation? The only person racing connected that I could put into, well, no, I can put two racing connected people into my family, but I don't think you'll have got one of them. You might have got the other. My great grandmother was a Miss Beecher, and Captain Martin Beecher of Beecher's Brook is spelt the same, and people said, is he part of the family? But no one could ever find him on any family tree. But I'm not sure he was. I think he was a bit of a wrong on occasions in the when he started life in the Grand National in the mid 19th century. So maybe that's not such bad news. We couldn't find him. And I think on my mother's side, if you try really hard, talking of racing and a long time ago, you can probably get back to Charles II. What, are you about to shock me with some other revelation?
There's quite a bit of military history. Right. Your ancestors fought in the Battle of the Boyne.
Lysett's are from Ireland, and they got some land, and I think that was because they backed the winner of the Battle of the Boyne, went with William of Orange, as opposed to James II. So, and were basically Protestants, but little bits of Catholicism as well, and a few dark sheep in the family, black sheep in the family as well. So, did you find any racing?
I was doing the direct descendancy, so right. It did keep me, fascinated by that sort of thing. So it was very good to find that. So you were educated at Eton.
Yeah.
A lot of people, that would be an alien world. You know, can you just tell us a little bit, a bit of an insight what it's like to have an education at an establishment like that?
Well, boarding schools. So that's the first and most important difference to, I suppose, a majority of schools. Some people call it, well, it probably is the best known educational establishment, certainly in the country, probably in the world. And it irritates, I know, quite a lot of my friends who were at Eton as well, that if you all you need to do is to have been at Eton, and you could be the Prime Minister, for example, and immediately you're the old Etonian Boris Johnson or David Cameron, or indeed lots of other Prime Ministers in the past. But if you went to any other private school, you're never the old whatever person of that particular school. Very traditional in terms of teaching, in terms of the uniform, which is tailcoats and pinstripe trousers. And I don't think anyone disputes that it must be a reasonable education, because I certainly don't include myself in this bracket, but plenty of people have done relatively well who have emerged from an Eton education. Though, as we sit here now, whether people say that exactly about Boris Johnson, who was a contemporary of mine, I'm not sure. I don't think I know a single person who went through Eton for 4.5, 5 years who didn't have a good education. So that's a plus point. But in other ways, it's a bit of a millstone around your neck, because at every opportunity you're judged because of a school that's been going since the mid-1400s as being a posh boy or someone who feels they're entitled to this and or entitled to that. Whether I'm posh or not, I'm not sure. Family history that you've investigated doesn't entirely bear that out. But whether I feel entitled to anything, I can absolutely assure you I feel entitled to nothing. I'll tell you what, just before you go on from the family history thing, if I say to you, this is nothing to do with Eton, but if I said to you these two places, Buttevant and Doneraile, what would you say in response? Well, the first ever steeplechase was between the church at Buttevant, which is a village in North Cork, County Cork, to Doneraile, which is another village in North County Cork, and my family comes from Doneraile. So that's a racing moment. That's why it's called steeplechasing, because it was from the church in Buttevant to the church in Doneraile, both of which I assume have got steeples. Also why it's called point to pointing, because it was from one point to another. And one of the riders, sorry, we'll continue back on your running order in a second. One of the riders was called Cornelius. So I always quite enjoy that.
Excellent.
So that was the first ever steeplechase in the mid 1750 something, 1760, round about that sort of era.
So geographically, it's definitely in the blood anyway.
Oh, geographically, absolutely.
So we mentioned there's military history in your family. Was there ever any pressure to follow suit?
There's no military in my immediate family. So no, thank goodness. Actually, my mother's family were naval, and again, no pressure to go in that route. Horse racing was something I was going to do from a very early age, in my own mind, anyway.
Okay, so that my next question being, what did spark your interest in horse racing initially?
Don't really know. I'd love to be able to say I have such a clear memory of going to the races for the first time and whoopee, that was going to be my thing. But I have no recollection of going to the races for the first time. I know where it will have been. It will have been to Hereford Racecourse, because I grew up in that part of the world, close to Hereford. And I know I've got a race card somewhere, I think from when I was 3 years old, the Whitsun Bank Holiday fixture, which was huge at Hereford in the 1960s and 70s and early 80s. I've got a race card, and I can vaguely remember going to that fixture, but I know that wasn't the first time I went, because we went with some friends and I bossed them around like nobody's business. I think probably went because Hereford was close by, my father was keen. My uncle on my mother's side owned the winner of the Cambridgeshire in 1973. And I remember huge excitement. He was very matey with Ian Balding, who trained the horse. And so prior to Siciliana winning the Cambridgeshire in 1973, ridden by Jeff Lewis, prior to that, we'd been to Kingsclere to see Mill Reef. And, you know, Mill Reef, you know, we talk in the sort of 21st century, we talk about prolific horses like Enable, like Yates, these type of horses, but they didn't have quite the, however big they were within the racing bubble, they didn't have the widespread reputation and charisma that that say Mill Reef did back in the 1970s. Red Rum, Desert Orchid, those, Corto Star probably did, and Denman probably did, to be fair. But most haven't had quite that thing. And Mill Reef was like a god, an equine god. And I remember going to a cricket match at Kingsclear when I was fairly young. A cricket match, because Ian Balding was mad about cricket as well as racing, so he had some kind of charity event. And the sort of tea time treat, the tea time interval treat, was to go and meet Mill Reef, and the excitement, I cannot tell you. And it was the most beautiful sunny day, and Kingsclear is huge now, but at the time there were probably only 70 horses compared to 200 now, and so it was a massively exciting moment. It was like sort of going to the end of the garden slightly, and there was a cricket pitch over there and there was Mill Reef over there, so it was great excitement. So, you know, I was into things like that. I used to follow my uncle's horses very closely. My parents had a friend, I think, who had a few horses under permit. Herefordshire was a good area as well, because in the next door village to us, there was, in fact, in two villages next to us, there were a couple of permit holders. So that added to the interest. I remember being told that Bob Davis, who was a, you know, later a racing administrator, but B.R. Davis, as he appeared on the race card, was looking at buying the house just down the road from us to live in. And the thought of Bob Davis living in the same lane would have been very exciting. And Terry Biddlecombe had the same GP, and I definitely saw him in the... I was keener to probably a bit too over-enthusiastic about going to the GP in the hope that we might see Terry Biddlecombe for a second time. We never did. But horsey part of the country, slight horsey connection within the family. And, you know, it's, you know, maybe it goes back to the genes. You know, why do people like suddenly like football or like politics from absolutely nowhere? So it was a bit like that with me and racing.
OK, now you mentioned that you were always going to be involved in racing. So what were your ambitions when you were at school? What did you have in mind?
Well, I wrote an essay. I was in the same class, actually, as Marcus Armitage, who's now racing correspondent, who became racing correspondent of the Daily Telegraph. And he can't remember this, but I've got a clear memory of us being told to write an essay about what we wanted to be doing in middle age. And the chap was called Angus Graham Campbell, who taught us. And Mr. Graham Campbell said, "You've got to write, I want you to write an essay." So what am I, 12, 13, 14 years old, something like that. And we've got to write an essay about what one wants to be doing in middle age. And in retrospect, obviously, unfortunately, the document doesn't exist now, but I'd have written almost down to the last letter, BBC, almost down to the last letter, what I wanted to be doing. You know, Peter O'Sullivan, Peter Bromley were the big people for the BBC at the time. I suppose I probably wanted to be a commentator, but actually that's really quite hard. And to be able to talk and write about it was, and tell, you know, storytelling is the massive expression, to storytell, to tell the stories of horse racing. That was what really attracted me.
So, Cornelius, during this time when you were getting involved with racing, was betting a part of it?
Not really. I've always had a theory that people get into racing for one of three reasons. One is the love of the horse, and because they've been around horses all their lives. Well, that was definitely not me. Another reason is because people love a bet, and that, again, a little tiny bit, but not really. I was probably not very good at it, was the good reason for that. Though I do remember, I have a clear memory of the first bet I ever had, which was at Chepstow, circa 1972, 73. And the only reason I backed it was called Deblin's Green, won the Welsh Grand National, ridden by Nigel Wackley, who became a starter, and his son Rupert Wackley was a good jockey as well. And Deblin's Green was a village not very far from us, and I'd seen that, you know, driven past quite a lot of times, and it said Deblin's Green down to the left-hand side. So I thought I definitely backed that on the tote. But I think probably early 70s, even if you were clearly underage, probably people weren't quite as strict about not taking bets as they are now. And I remember backing Churchtown Boy to ridiculously to beat Red Rum. Actually, it was the Grand National, you know, and this isn't a unique story, is it? But I definitely backed Churchtown Boy to beat Red Rum in 1977. He finished second. I often used to go to the house of a friend on Grand National Day, whose father always fancied himself as a bit of a sort of one-day-a-year bookmaker. And I said that I fancied a horse in the Grand National. In fact, I fancied two. I think it was Lord Browndodd, who was a good old chaser that used to pop up at Aintree every year in the mid-70s, and the Pilgarlic, who must have run in the Grand National about four or five times. And I backed them both. And he said, the father of the friend said, these can't possibly win. So he didn't back them. He just stuck the bets. He just laid them himself. And I have a feeling that the two of them were still bang there jumping the last. And he did gulp a little bit. Mid-70s, having to sort of shell out 50 quid would have been really quite a lot. But happily for him, Lord Browndodd and the Pilgarlic, they never won. They were always in the sort of first 5, 6, 7 in Grand Nationals. So yeah, Grand National sort of person. And you know, now I'm really happy to occasionally have a fiver on something. And if it wins and I win 20 quid, you know, and it sounds a bit pathetic, but I thoroughly enjoy that. And I've got little hares in horses and little bits of horses. And I think once we had a little bit of a touch one day, a couple of times had a little bit of a touch. But honestly, I had 20 quid on an 8-1 shot that won. Winning 160 pounds suited me very well indeed. It's just not a massive motivation.
Okay, so the motivation was it writing or broadcasting?
Well, broadcasting, but storytelling. It's, you know, there are so many, you know, we've mentioned a few horses already. You know, the Pilgarlic, who turns up in every Grand National and always gets, practically always gets round and runs well, Red Rum, those kind of horses. And more recently, being able to tell the story of the horses, you know, whether the horses that spring straight into my mind when I think that are horses like Lock Song, horses like Persian Punch in the 1990s. More recently, I don't know, the stories like Sir Percy winning a Derby, Yates winning all those Gold Cups, the Queen's Horse Estimate winning the Gold Cup at Royal Ascot, Quarto Star, Denman. And so to be able to tell those type of stories, and for an audience, the audience I had when I was at the BBC wasn't a racing audience. It was an audience that liked a good story, hopefully. So be able to tell those stories, the story of the jockeys championships, the rise of Frankie Dettori, the rise of Oisin Murphy, the rise of A.P. McCoy, the Dunwoodies going right back, the Scudamores, all these kind of people, and the trainers and the owners. So there are so many good stories, and on the odd occasion, they all come together. For example, I can't think of a better example than the Sussex Stakes of 2020, when Marcus Tregoning, a great character who's been in the wilderness for a bit, comes together with a good horse in Merhatha, owned by one of the big names, Sheikh Hamdan, etc. And then it's a thrilling horse race. And you don't very often get all those different elements at the same time. So to be able to tell those stories and the broadcasting side of it, I just probably like the sound of my own voice. But the writing was something I had to do for the BBC, and so I just sort of learnt about roughly how to do it, and gradually sort of tried to polish things up.
Well, listening to you, anybody listening to this, your enthusiasm is infectious. So
I always people say that, which is kind, but I'm no cheerleader. I always used to think people said, "Oh, you're so enthusiastic," and I am enthusiastic about it. But when things are bad, and there are lots of examples in every walk of life, but certainly in horse racing, when things aren't good, when people aren't behaving as doing as well as perhaps I believe they should be doing, then I'm quite happy to have a little pop at them on those occasions. And those people who just constantly come up and say, on a really average day's racing, but it happens to be Ascot, and say, "Good racing." And you think, no, it's not good racing, it's rubbish racing. So that kind of that false enthusiasm I don't like. But I am enthusiastic about the sport because there are lots of good stories to tell. It is exciting, it's not boring, and not enough people necessarily appreciate that.
Okay, even if you went to Eton, it wasn't that easy to get your toe in the door back in those days, I would imagine. So where did you get your break?
Well, certainly it was nothing to do with Eton. Nothing to do with it at all. It was to do with a drinking pal of my father's, to be honest. Chap was a director of, a family friend, who's a director of a little radio station, little commercial radio station in Gloucester, called Seven Sound Radio. He said, I can't get you a job there, but I can get you an opportunity to meet the programme director, programme controller, who was good enough to, because commercial radio, well, probably all local radio, but particularly commercial radio in the 1980s worked like that. If somebody was enthusiastic enough to be prepared to come along for practically no money, then they could have some kind of a role. So I went along there. They said, do you want to come back? I said, I'd love to. And came back on a Monday in July. It was the week that Prince Charles and Princess Diana got married. Started there on the Monday. And I think for whatever reason, I was broadcasting practically by Tuesday afternoon, if not slightly quicker. And there were some great stories in Gloucestershire at the time. There was a spy at GCHQ in Cheltenham, which was a huge story at the time. Prince Charles, Princess Anne, Prince and Princess Michael of Kent, they all moved into the area at the time, and there were just lots of good stories. There was a really sad outbreak of meningitis in the area. There was a big immigration story involving a vicar from Gloucestershire and his wife from Russia. You know, there were all sorts of good stories to tell, and I had an enormous amount of fun telling those stories to a relatively small audience. But from my point of view, the biggest break of being able to work at Seven Sound Radio in Gloucestershire was that Cheltenham Racecourse was on the doorstep and no one particularly wanted. There were people who did a bit of sports reporting, but they wanted to do football or they wanted to do rugby unions, big in that area, wanted to do Gloucestershire cricket probably, but nobody particularly wanted to go to the races. So I must have gone the end of that year to report on racing at Cheltenham for that radio station. Guy that ran Cheltenham was a guy called Edward Gillespie, who was definitely something of a mentor. I probably wasn't much of a protege, but he was definitely a mentor. And he knew of another job that had come up with an organisation called Race Call, which did that cutting edge thing at the time of putting racing commentaries on the telephone, which was 0898 and 0891. And all the telephone lines at the time, so we're late 80s, they all had the same prefix. So whether it was racing from Redcar or it was some porn line, they all started with the same 0898 or 0891. I think the 0891 was when they split, but certainly to start with, they all had the same kind of number. And if you were after racing at Redcar and your finger pressed one wrong button, you could end up with all sorts of excitements.
Now, you also, writing has been a big thing. So it run parallels. So you've written for several publications. I've just got a few. London Evening Standard, Horse and Hound, Sunday Mirror, The Times, The Guardian. So it's a fairly eclectic mix, actually.
Well, none of them were sort of full-time. Horse and Hound was quite full-time. Michael Seeley was a brilliant guy who was the racing correspondent of The Times and of the Horse and Hound. And he got very ill for a few years before he died. So I used to stand in. And then when he did sadly die, I was Audax in the Horse and Hound, so following the footsteps of Seeley and John Oakesy. So, fairly big footprints to try and fill. Other things, I had a column in The Times for a bit. Yeah, that was because the late Alan Lee was the racing correspondent of The Times, and they decided, as well as having sort of straightforward reporting, they wanted to have a column of just sort of chat. And so he very kindly sorted me out for that, Alan. So I did that for a few years. The Guardian, again, I did a few comment. I think I big my CV, whichever part of the internet you found, I've been bigging up my my CV rather dramatically here. But the Times was quite big. The Horse and Hound was quite big. Standard, I used to stand in for Christopher Poole, who was the legendary racing correspondent of the Standard, who was an enormous character in every sense of the word. He was a big fella, but he had a big personality as well. Sunday Mirror I did for a year. That was a good fun year, because that was an opportunity to do exactly what I'm just saying to you, to tell some stories and to really bring people to life, bring the sport to life in a pretty significant Sunday newspaper for a period of time.
Okay, so when was the first year you got the coveted RCA press badge?
Early 90s sometime. I think initially it was actually the coveted RCA badge for a few years. I think the BBC had just always had RCA badges rather than the press badge. I remember when we switched over, because the almost the most important condition of the media recognition from the RCA is that when you retire, you can get a retired person's equivalent, which means basically you can go to the races for nothing. And when I switched from an RCA badge after quite a long time to the press badge, as they call it, my first call was Caroline Davis at the RCA. Can I just confirm that you don't, because I think you had to have served a certain length of time with a badge. So I said, if I find myself retiring after only a few years with the press badge, I can still have the retirement badge, can't I? Which fortunately, they said I could. I haven't retired, so it hasn't come about. But I joined the BBC in 1990. Peter Bromley was the racing commentator and correspondent, but he wanted to just concentrate on commentaries. So I did quite a lot more reporting, and we did. In terms of the level of racing on BBC Radio, which I always did BBC Radio, not TV, there was a lot. There was plenty of stuff on there from. So I started August 1990 and I left April 2020. And throughout that period, there was a lot of stuff on. It became increasingly hard to get stuff on. But there was plenty of stuff on over that time. Broke a few stories, not that many, but broke a few. Was able to go to a news and it's Five Live news and sport audience. So not a racing audience, but a much more general audience with, some interesting stories, bit of storytelling along the way, and hopefully that just the best thing when I left the BBC, the amount of people who said no interest in racing, never been interested in racing, but I really enjoyed listening to your stuff on the radio, which was the biggest compliment that anyone could possibly have paid.
Interesting what you said at the end of the last piece, Cornelius. Do you think that there is a potentially huge audience for racing that just don't actually know it yet, and they need to be sold it?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of doubt about that. And the evidence came during the pandemic when people couldn't go to the races. People, for a period during the COVID-19 pandemic, couldn't do anything and had to stay at home and maybe go for a walk every day. And that was about it. And the fact is that when the racing resumed, which during that year, racing resumed in June, the figures for ITV were really strong. So the fact is that if you do racing, if you cover racing, if you transmit racing in a, I was about to say palatable, but that's not actually the right expression, in an easy to follow manner, which ITV does pretty well, which the BBC when I was there did fairly well, because it wasn't packed full of jargon and in jokes and things like that. Racing's big problem is it's got two really fabulous racing dominated channels, Sky Racing and Racing TV. So therefore the real enthusiasts, they can do that. So you've got to work really hard to get, because on a Saturday afternoon, certainly I find myself watching a bit of ITV, and then inevitably there's a race at Kelso that isn't covered on ITV, or a race at Bath that isn't covered on Sky, and you switch over. So you've got you've got these two really good channels, but you've got to work extra hard to get completely new people. But there are plenty of new people around, And it's a case of making it easy to follow, making it attractive, making it not just about one thing, not just about form, not just about betting, not just about fashion, but making it as easy to follow as possible. And people will find they really, really enjoy it. And we've, you know, betting is not a is not seen as a particularly worthwhile pastime. In fact, it's seen as a negative pastime by some people in the outside world. So, you know, accentuate the fact that a horse is 5-1, but also accentuate all the people around it and what it's achieving and its backstory, as has been so good with, say, Enable. Such a good story to tell. And there have been other, you know, other really good, Quarto Star in Denman, that was a good story to tell because they were neighbours in the stables where they worked. You know, et cetera, et cetera. So you've just got to accentuate the positive, make it easy to follow. And of course there's a big audience, because anyone who thinks that horse racing is basically boring, clearly it's like saying football's boring. Of course football's not boring. Of course cricket's not boring. Golf is, but in my opinion. But no, that's a poor joke. But, you know, the fact is these things aren't, whether it's golf, cricket, football, rugby union, tennis, they're not boring. Because, you know, tennis, I don't know anything about tennis, but as soon as I start following my friends at Roland Garros, who tell the stories behind the stories, if you like, it all comes to life, and that's what racing's got to do as well.
Okay, you mentioned betting there. Do you think that in the public opinion, and a lot of things has changed over the last 10, 20 years, do you think that betting being an intrinsic part of horse racing is a detriment to horse racing?
It's not a plus, is it? Because people who don't know anything about it say, oh, it's all about getting people into problem gambling situations, which it's just not. Most people who bet, whether it's on the track or it's in a betting shop or it's online or whatever, most people are betting pretty small, just having a bit of fun here, a bit of fun there, like the Grand National, like the Derby, or whatever. Obviously, there are problem gamblers, and it's really important that the big betting organisations identify those people and make certain people can't spiral out of control. But that's no real difference to the breweries making certain their customers don't spiral out of control, or other areas of life where people can spiral out of control. And I think there's stacks of evidence to show that the bookmakers are doing great jobs identifying people who maybe they didn't, not all of them did a brilliant job in the past, but in the modern day, all the various people, whether it's the bookmakers themselves or the bookmakers' watchdogs, the Betting and Gaming Council, those type of organisations, they are looking, they're spending a fortune making certain that people are gamble aware. You know, when the fun stops, stop. It's a great line. But most people, we mustn't get completely sort of in a tangle over this whole thing, because most people are very happy to have £1, £2, £3, £4, £5, maybe £10 occasionally every now and again, and it is part of the experience, and that's great. But it's obviously the people who are spending a lot of money and able to spend a huge amount of money and have been allowed to spend a lot of money on the peripheral things. It's been allowed to get out of control, and that isn't acceptable, but it's great that the industry is actually trying to address that.
Okay, getting away from the betting shops and back on the turf, in your very extensive career, this is probably going to be quite difficult, but the most memorable horse racing event that you've had the pleasure of witnessing?
Well, when I left the BBC, I was asked to name my top 10 races, John Hunt, my colleague, at the BBC, when I left, he was the commentator, said, you could have just done 10 Grand Nationals, couldn't you? And I said, you could have done 25 Grand Nationals. So I had to do it down into 10 races, and it was an almost impossible task. So, but what I thought I'd do, I couldn't decide between two or three for the number one. So I went for the one that I knew that other people wouldn't guess. So I think Sir Percy winning the Derby, which was a very memorable one for me, and the Quarto Star and Denman rivalry was, you know, they were vying for top spot. But I actually went back to the 1990s, to the Royal and Sun Alliance Hurdle of 1994. And I was talking about races that encapsulate everyone, the horse, the people, the story, and the race itself. And the Royal and Sun Alliance Hurdle of 1994 was won by an Irish horse called Denoli, trained on a farm in County Carlow by Tom Foley, who had, I remember going there, and he had the horse here and he had cattle there. It was the most perfect example of grassroots sport. And they'd gone from the grassroots to the very top and were favourites. Oh, not just favourites, but hot favourites for the Sun Alliance Hurdle at Cheltenham, which is now that's now called the Neptune Investments. It's the 2.5 mile novice hurdle, 2 miles, 5 furlong novice hurdle at Cheltenham. Charlie Swan, champion jockey of Ireland, rode. The whole of Ireland seemed to be behind the horse. And I will never forget the moment when Charlie Swan struck for home a long way out. And the roar was such at Cheltenham that day that Peter O'Sullivan, commentating on television, thought something had happened. So he was just momentarily distracted because of this noise. And he thought something dramatic must have happened. And was he missing it? But he absolutely wasn't missing it, because this enormous gamble on this horse, Denoli, and it'd been the guy who owned it. Did he have a, I think he had a child called, no, his name was Dan, and his daughter was called Olivia. So Denoli was a combination of their names. And Tom Foley had never been out of Ireland before. He'd never been on an aeroplane. I think he had to fly over. It was the perfect grassroots, rose to the top. It would be like, you know, if you had a football analogy, it would be like, I was about to say Forest Green Rovers, but they're in the Football League now. But it would be your really small, your Salford, well, they're in the Football League as well, but the tiny team making it to the cup final and seeing off everybody in great style. So Denoli for that Sun Alliance hurdle, and Denoli continued to be one of the great horses of the 1990s as well. And that would be my favourite result.
So you just brought that alive again, didn't you? And how about human characters?
It's not particularly original to say it, but Sir Henry Cecil was an extraordinary character to deal with. And what his story was one of great horses winning great races. He won the Derby, did he, 4 times, Reference Point and Slip Anchor and Oath and Commander-in-Chief. Great horses, great races, great jockeys were his story, but his story was such a really human story as well. The fact that he was right up there, that he went down into the doldrums, diagnosed with cancer, battled back. He won the Oaks, I think, when he battled back, and then he had Frankel towards the end of his career. In fact, he died a few months after Frankel had been retired to stud, and he died just before Royal Ascot in the year that he died. And I can rarely remember his widow, Jane, Lady Cecil, trained a winner at Royal Ascot a week later. And the sense of emotion buzzing around the place. It was the same day, actually, that the Queen's horse won the Gold Cup Estimate. And that was one of the great, I think probably the greatest race day I ever reported on, because the Cecil horse that had won was a massive story in itself. And I remember being really quite proud of talking to her afterwards, because this was an incredibly difficult situation. The place was in mourning for Sir Henry, but clearly not as much as his family and indeed his widow. And she just won this race. And I thought, you know, I've got to ask her a decent question here about the emotion of the day. But equally, I don't want her to look at me and say, you horrible so-and-so for asking me such an insensitive question. And I can't remember what the question was, but I remember it can't have been too bad, because A, she gave a lovely answer to it. And being a radio man, she spoke for about 25 seconds and I thought, clip, lovely. One of my most esteemed colleagues, now retired, subsequently retired, Claude Duval, patted me on the shoulder afterwards and he said, that was a bloody good question. And I was really proud of that. So the whole Sir Henry Cecil story was an epic story. One of flat racing's greats, but one of British sports greats as well. As I say, a very human story.
Hey Cornelius, you talked with passion about Royal Ascot in the last part there. Now you've delved into ownership a bit. Was there anything of that level?
Oh, no. No, I always joke that that the Sheikhs have Royal Ascot. JP McManus has Cheltenham. Aintree is a great event as well, and I have Perth, and in terms of festivals, and the Perth Festival is my absolute favourite week of the whole year. Perth Festival takes place in April, and I have had two winners at Perth festivals over the years. A horse called Bordone, ridden by an amateur jockey called Chris Bonner in the mid-1990s, Mr. C. Bonner. That horse was Bordone. He won four races in under 12 months. Never won again, actually. But in that time, he won 18,000 quid in the mid-90s. And subsequently, when people have grumbled about... I don't grumble about prize money because... any ownership I'm involved in is utterly, utterly just as a hobby. But I appreciate that prize money is very important to a lot of people. So the mighty Bordone, as we used to call him, Mr. C. Bonner, he won his fourth and final race for me at Perth. And then I didn't have another winner at Perth. I had a minor winner at Perth. Called Lion Guest, trained by Susan Bradburn and the Bradburn family. There was Susan and Johnny. She was a trainer. Johnny, Mr. J. Bradburn, he was an amateur rider. And Mark Bradburn, their son, was a professional jockey. And Lorna, their daughter, is a trainer, became a trainer in Ireland as Mrs. Lorna Fowler. She married a chap called Harry Fowler. And they were big mates, and we had a number of horses with them. Very grand of me. I was involved in a number of horses with them. One of them won at Perth, which was very exciting. And then a horse called Almir Dulir was a mudlark who had a mind of his own. And his form figures, it was as though we were up to something. His form figures every year used to be P, 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 might have been the odd R in there, but certainly mainly P's. But every year he used to get to air at the end of February. And it was something about air. His ears pricked, and off he went. And he won the same. I'm sure you're okay with my language here, but I always describe it. I always said to Susan, everyone said to Henrietta Knight, how fantastic to win the Cheltenham Gold Cup 3 years running with Best Mate. You have won the same race for shit horses in shit ground for shit money at air at the end of February in shit weather. You did it for that 4 years, 3 years running. That is one of the great training performances of all time. And every year, people seem to, after it happened the first time, people seem to work it out. Well, it certainly wasn't me, because we were the subject of quite big gambles then, the second year and the third year. So the form figures used to go PPPP1, PPPP1, PPP1. And then on the third time, she rang, I wasn't there, and she rang and she said, because the horse hadn't been that well, I said, I think, why don't we call it a day now? And she says, best news you've ever given me. Then I've had other winners at Perth. When Susan Bradburn retired, I got involved with the Alexander family, who are great trainers at a place called Kynaston, which is sort of Kinross in the middle of Scotland, or middle of the south part of Scotland, southern half of Scotland, and had a lot of fun with horses there, funnily enough, at Perth and also at Ayr again. So Ayr has been quite... a lucky track involved with a horse called Craig and Boy that could probably walk to Ayr on his own he's been there so often, and he won a couple of races at Ayr. The other owners are friends, the trainer's friend, the jockey, a fellow called Grant Coburn, doesn't get as many opportunities perhaps as he should do. And so when things work out on those occasions, it's absolutely fantastic. I was talking earlier on about misplaced enthusiasm and being a cheerleader. This is genuine. This isn't misplaced enthusiasm. This is just the love of the other side of what we all do. And it's probably a bit expensive, and it's probably a ridiculous extravagance, but my God, it's good fun.
Now, you've obviously like racecourses in Scotland. Do any of those feature in your book, which we must mention?
You happen to... Oh, just well, World Racecourses by Cornelius Lycett. No, I'm slightly ashamed there aren't any Scottish courses in there, but it was 100 racecourses from around the world. So maybe there have to be a volume two. But the thing about Scotland, people say, why, you live in the south of England. You haven't got a drop of Scottish blood in you. What on earth are you doing in Scotland? But racing in Scotland is, to me, what racing in the south of England used to be. There's nothing wrong with racing in the south of England now. But it's quite old-fashioned. It's not backward, but it's old-fashioned. Everyone knows everybody. Especially around places like Perth and Ayr and Kelso, there's some really serious sport out on the track, but there's a bit of a party atmosphere off the track. People are determined to enjoy themselves, and it's just maybe the pace of racing life in Scotland and the north of England, to be fair, is just one step slower than the south of England, which I find very, very attractive. It does mean that getting to the races is not quite so easy. I had a trip to Ayr. I remember I thought the stars were aligned. This was Craig and Boy, which I mentioned, running, and it would have been my late father's 85th birthday. And I remember thinking that's surely part of the whole thing. So I live not a million miles from Birmingham Airport. I got the 9 o'clock flight to Birmingham. Nick Alexander and his wife Rose were there to give me a lift from the racecourse down to the. From the airport down to the racecourse, Ayr racecourse. When things resume after the behind closed doors, they do the most fantastic catering for everybody, particularly for owners. The sun was out, the birds were singing. Grant Coburn, our jockey, was in the paddock looking confident, and so everything was absolutely right. I actually had, for me, quite a big bet on the horse as well. He'd run well in his previous two races at Wetherby and Haydock, and they're under starter's orders. Says the announcer, they're off, which was true in the case of 9 out of 10 of them. But unfortunately, Craig and Boy decided that day that he wasn't going anywhere. So all this effort, Birmingham Airport, Glasgow Airport, Ayr, lunch, bloody blah and bloody blah. And in fact, he tried it again the following time, tried to refuse, but ended up finishing second. So the great, it's a bit like those James Herriot books used to be called It Should Never Happen to a Vet. I think, or one of them was called It Should Never Happen to a Racehorse Owner. But you know that things have got to be bad and things go wrong to make the good days even better than they'd otherwise be.
I can just tell you, thanks to my research yesterday, if you go back far enough, Lycett was actually prefixed Muck.
Well, there are some Muck Lycetts around. There's quite a famous Muck Lycett called Edward or Ned. Who was quite involved in Irish independence in the early part of the 20th century. And he, I think, maintained that the name should have been Muck Lycett. But we were Lycett. And people ask me, was there ever a shortening of Lycett? And there is, your research hasn't been that good, Simon, because you'd have spotted that Lycett is an anagram of ghastly. So L-Y-S-A-G-H-T becomes G-H-A-S-T-L-Y. And that's one of the few, until I like to think it became so obviously inappropriate, I was known as Mr. Ghastly at school. And I've always, one of my dreams would be able to name a racehorse, and Mr. Ghastly could easily be a name that I would call a horse. Hopefully he'd be good so that Ghastly was inappropriate in headlines as well.
Which leads us nicely on. We go back just briefly to the fact that racing has been jettisoned by the BBC, the Times, by and large, other big players. Do you think that it can fall in favour again, or is that it?
Oh, I think it can unquestionably fall in favour again. I dare say if you actually, those people who can, the John Randalls of this world, who can look at racing from 1750 right the way through to whatever the date is when he's considering these things. There have been ups and downs. There have been times when people have been out of love with racing. There have been times when the monarch hasn't been interested in Royal Ascot, I'm sure. Of course, life is all about peaks and troughs, and it is a roller coaster. And you know what is it that would bring it back? Well, if bring it back into the top of the agenda, if we knew that, we could wave our magic wand and we could get that sorted. At the moment, it's not as popular as it has been. But equally, you know, golf's not as popular as it has been. If you look at the audience figures, football is really, really popular. You know, it seems impossible to imagine that football's going to fall out of favour. But I'm confident that there are peaks and troughs. Quite when it'll happen, we've no idea. But if you look at the big events, the Grand Nationals, the Royal Ascots, then the interest in those type of events, they continue to be high. It's just harder on a day-to-day basis. But perhaps it's actually our expectations have been too high in the past. Those movers and shakers to which I referred earlier on, they were into racing. You know, Winston Churchill was a well-known owner breeder. Well, you couldn't imagine a politician being like that now. The Queen is obviously is the best known woman in the world, and she's an owner breeder. But you know, things do fall in and out of fashion. Whether it's jockeys, whether it's trainers, whether it's horses, whether it's stallions, whether it's the sport itself, and hopefully there will be a way back. But maybe we need to concentrate on the Saturdays, on the big events, for them to be big, and then the actual bread and butter stuff that happens during the week has to sort of be more what you might call betting shop fodder. Perhaps. I don't know the solution. If I did, then I'd be applying for a very senior job in racing administration, and I'd be like Admiral Rouse of many years ago, pushing the sport forward. But at the moment, that's not very likely to happen.
Well, one of the things, you've dived headlong into the world of social media, it seems, since you left the BBC. So do you think these days, with all the opportunities to broadcast, people to broadcast themselves, etc., that is, the big names are no longer that important as they would have been, and that there's a great opportunity for racing to promote itself?
Well, I don't know about it. Yeah, the fact is, Instagram, the fact is, all these things, Twitter, which is the main one that I got into, TikTok, I don't, that's got to be the next boundary to have a go at, Facebook, obviously, as well.
The podcasts and
podcasts, yeah. The Cornelius Cast comes out every fortnight or so, and hopefully will continue to do so. You know, we can't be sniffy about these things. You know, people, colleagues of mine, media colleagues, say, "Oh, I could only get X number of words in the paper, but I got 500 words on the website." Well, you know, the fact is, quite likely that there are more people looking at the website and have easy access to the website than would be buying the paper. So it's just, you know, things are moving on, and we have to embrace those. And, you know, some of the racecourses have embraced, and racecourse groups have embraced social media spectacularly. Goodwood, you know, the middle of, during the pandemic, there was nothing for Goodwood to do. And they staged a duck race on a river and put them all in the colours of the last. We're giving the names of these ducks on this stream the names of the horses who won the last 10 Goodwood Cups or something, or whatever they did. Big names from Goodwood, anyway. And those type of innovative things. And you suddenly find yourself getting tens of thousands of hits on that kind of thing. You know, when I left the BBC, I did one of those things that become very fashionable. I have some personal news for you, and did a little video for Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. And they got hundreds of thousands of hits. So the answer is, should the 3 o'clock at Newmarket, however important it is, Group 1 be on BBC Radio? Well, obviously it's a great pity that it's not, but perhaps we're judging everything by standards that actually existed in the past rather than the more modern day ones. So racing must embrace all these things, and gradually it is doing so, and very successfully. Goodwood, you know, I love Goodwood, we all love Goodwood. They've done it particularly successfully.
Okay, so finally, what's on the horizon? What have you got your sights set on in the near future?
Just sort of working away, telling stories, but from a storytelling within horse racing from a slightly different angle. You know, podcasts offer all sorts of possibilities. You know, when I left the BBC, was pretty much in the first 3 weeks, month or so of the pandemic, so therefore, you know, there was not much optimism, not much money, people just looking to survive as opposed to thinking forward into the years ahead. But gradually, people are becoming more optimistic, are looking further forward. There is storytelling. Racing has got to get those good stories out. You know, we can't rely on Frankie Dettori for forever. We've got to push the new characters forward, make certain they have a good profile, and I want to be part of that as much as possible. So, fingers crossed.
And finally, autobiography?
God, a bit boring, I think. No, I'd love the challenge of doing a memoir of some sort. Whether especially in this in an age when books are, well, I say books are less fashionable than they were. My family business, my parents had a bookshop in the town of South Herefordshire, town of Ross-on-Wye, and when the internet came along in the 1990s, their friends said, no one will be buying books in the future, but that bookshop continued until they retired for another 15, 20 years. So the fact of the matter is, books in some form will continue to exist, and some kind of a memoir, maybe trying to bring together the various different mediums, whether it's social media, TV, et cetera, et cetera, and books as well, maybe something like that. But let's hope so, and let's keep healthy, and let's keep optimistic and keep moving forward.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to that, Cornelius Lyson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's not just online betting at Star Sports. You can call us too on 08000 5-1 3-1 and speak directly to one of our friendly and experienced traders. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.